or at the very least to develop a fondness for the iconography and rituals of one or another religion. But not all paths traverse the same rough ground. There are methods of meditation that do not require any artifice or unwarranted assumptions at all. For beginners, I usually recommend a technique called Vipassana, Pali for insight, which comes from the oldest tradition of Buddhism, the Theravada. One of the advantages of Vipassana is that it can be taught in an entirely secular way. Experts in this practice generally acquire their training in a Buddhist context, and most retreat centers in the United States and Europe teach its associated Buddhist philosophy. Nevertheless, this method of introspection can be brought within any secular or scientific context without embarrassment. The same cannot be said for the practice of chanting to Lord Krishna while banging a drum. That is why Vipassana is now being widely studied and adopted by psychologists and neuroscientists. The quality of mind cultivated in Vipassana is almost always referred to as mindfulness, and the literature on its psychological benefits is now substantial. There's nothing spooky about mindfulness. It is simply a state of clear, non-judgmental, and undistracted attention to the contents of consciousness, whether pleasant or unpleasant. Cultivating this quality of mind has been shown to reduce pain, anxiety, and depression, improve cognitive function, and even produce changes in gray matter density in regions of the brain related to learning and memory, emotional regulation, and self-awareness. We will look more closely at the neurophysiology of mindfulness in a later chapter. Mindfulness is a translation of the Pali word sati. The term has several meanings in the Buddhist literature, but for our purposes, the most important is clear awareness. The practice was first described in the Satipatthana Sutta, which is part of the Pali Canon. Like many Buddhist texts, the Satipatthana Sutta is highly repetitive, and for anything but an avid student of Buddhism, exceptionally boring to read. However, when one compares texts of this kind with the Bible or the Quran, the difference is unmistakable. The Satipatthana Sutta is not a collection of ancient myths, superstitions, and taboos. It is a rigorously empirical guide to freeing the mind from suffering. The Buddha described four foundations of mindfulness, which he taught as, quote, the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and grief, for the attainment of the true way, for the realization of nibbana. The Sanskrit word is nirvana. The four foundations of mindfulness are the body, breathing, changes in posture and activities, feelings, the senses of pleasantness and unpleasantness and neutrality, the mind, in particular its moods and attitudes, and the objects of mind, which include the five senses but also other mental states, such as volition, tranquility, rapture, equanimity, and even mindfulness itself. It is a peculiar list, at once redundant and incomplete, a problem that is compounded by the necessity of translating Pali terminology into English. The obvious message of the text, however, is that the totality of one's experience can become the field of contemplation. The meditator is merely instructed to pay attention, quote, ardently, and fully aware, and free from covetousness and grief for the world. There is nothing passive about mindfulness. One might even say that it expresses a specific kind of passion, a passion for discerning what is subjectively real in every moment. It is a mode of cognition that is, above all, undistracted, accepting, and ultimately non-conceptual. Being mindful is not a matter of thinking more clearly about experience. It is the act of experiencing more clearly, including the arising of thoughts themselves. Mindfulness is a vivid awareness of whatever is appearing in one's mind or body, thoughts, sensations, moods, without grasping at the pleasant or recoiling from the unpleasant. One of the great strengths of this technique of meditation, from a secular point of view, is that it does not require us to adopt any cultural affectations or unjustified beliefs. It simply demands that we pay close attention to the flow of our experience in each moment. The principal enemy of mindfulness or any meditative practice is our deeply conditioned habit of being distracted by thoughts. The problem is not thoughts themselves, but the state of thinking without knowing that we are thinking. In fact, thoughts of all kinds can be perfectly good objects of mindfulness. In the early stages of one's practice, however, the arising of thought will be more or less synonymous with distraction, that is, with a failure to meditate. Most people who believe they are meditating are merely thinking with their eyes closed. By practicing mindfulness, however, one can awaken from the dream of discursive thought and begin to see each arising image, idea, or bit of language vanish without a trace. What remains is consciousness itself, with its attendant sights, sounds, sensations, and thoughts, appearing and changing in every moment. In the beginning of one's meditation practice, the difference between ordinary experience and what one comes to consider mindfulness is not very clear, and it takes some training to distinguish between being lost in thought and seeing thoughts for what they are. In this sense, learning to meditate is just like acquiring any other skill. It takes many thousands of repetitions to throw a good jab or to coax music from the strings of a guitar. With practice, mindfulness becomes a well-formed habit of attention, and the difference between it and ordinary thinking will become increasingly clear. Eventually, it begins to seem as if you are repeatedly awakening from a dream to find yourself safely in bed. No matter how terrible the dream, the relief is instantaneous. And yet it is difficult to stay awake for more than a few seconds at a time. My friend Joseph Goldstein, one of the finest Vipassana teachers I know, likens this shift in awareness to the experience of being fully immersed in a film and then suddenly realizing that you're sitting in a theater watching a mere play of light on a wall. Your perception is unchanged, but the spell is broken. Most of us spend every waking moment lost in the movie of our lives. Until we see that an alternative to this enchantment exists, we are entirely at the mercy of appearances. Again, the difference I'm describing is not a matter of achieving a new conceptual understanding or of adopting new beliefs about the nature of reality. The change comes when we experience the present moment prior to the arising of thought. The Buddha taught mindfulness as the appropriate response to the truth of dukkha, usually translated from the Pali, somewhat misleadingly, as suffering. A better translation would be unsatisfactoriness. Suffering may not be inherent in life, but unsatisfactoriness is. We crave lasting happiness in the midst of change. Our bodies age, cherished objects break, pleasures fade, relationships fail. Our attachment to the good things in life and our aversion to the bad amount to a denial of these realities, and this inevitably leads to feelings of dissatisfaction. Mindfulness is a technique for achieving equanimity amid the flux, allowing us to simply be aware of the quality of experience in each moment, whether pleasant or unpleasant. This may seem like a recipe for apathy, but it needn't be. It is actually possible to be mindful and therefore to be at peace in the present moment, even while working to change the world for the better. Mindfulness meditation is extraordinarily simple to describe, but it isn't easy to perform. True mastery might require special talent and a lifetime of devotion to the task, and yet a genuine transformation of one's perception of the world is within reach for most of us. Practice is the only thing that will lead to success. The simple instructions given here are analogous to instructions on how to walk a tightrope, which I assume must go something like this. 1. Find a horizontal cable that can support your weight. 2. Stand on one end. 3. Step forward by placing one foot directly in front of the other. 4. Repeat. 5. Don't fall. Clearly, steps 2 through 5 entail a little trial and error. Happily, the benefits of training and meditation arrive long before mastery does, and falling, for our purposes, occurs almost ceaselessly, every time we become lost in thought. Again, the problem is not thoughts themselves, but the state of thinking without being fully aware that we are thinking. As every meditator soon discovers, distraction is the normal condition of our minds. Most of us topple from the wire every second, whether gliding happily into reverie or plunging into fear, anger, self-hatred, or other negative states of mind. Meditation is a technique for waking up. The goal is to come out of the trance of discursive thinking and to stop reflexively grasping at the pleasant and recoiling from the unpleasant, so that we can enjoy a mind undisturbed by worry, merely open like the sky, and effortlessly aware of the flow of experience in the present. How to meditate. Sit comfortably with your spine erect, either in a chair or cross-legged on a cushion. Close your eyes and take a few deep breaths, and feel the points of contact between your body and the chair or the floor. Notice the sensations associated with sitting. Feelings of pressure, warmth, tingling, vibration. Now gradually become aware of the process of breathing. Pay attention to wherever you feel the breath most distinctly, either at your nostrils or in the rising and falling of your abdomen. Allow your attention to rest in the mere sensation of breathing. You don't have to control your breath. Just let it come and go naturally. Every time your mind wanders into thought, just gently return it to the breath. And as you focus on the process of breathing, you'll also perceive sounds and bodily sensations or emotions. Simply observe these phenomena as they appear in consciousness, and then return to the breath. And the moment you notice that you've been lost in thought, observe the present thought itself as an object of consciousness. Watch what happens to it. And then return your attention to the breath or to any sounds or sensations arising in the next moment. Continue in this way until you can merely witness all objects of consciousness, sights, sounds, sensations, emotions, even thoughts themselves, as they arise and change and pass away. Those who are new to this practice generally find it useful to hear instructions of this kind spoken aloud during the course of a meditation session. I've posted guided meditations of varying length on my website. The truth of suffering. I'm sitting in a coffee shop in Midtown Manhattan, drinking exactly what I want, coffee, eating exactly what I want, a cookie, and doing exactly what I want, writing this book. It's a beautiful day, and many of the people passing by on the sidewalk appear to radiate good fortune from their pores. Several are so physically attractive that I'm beginning to wonder whether Photoshop can now be applied to the human body. Up and down this street, and for a mile in each direction, stores sell jewelry, art, and clothing that not even 1% of humanity could hope to purchase. So what did the Buddha mean when he spoke of the unsatisfactoriness, dukkha? Was he referring merely to the poor and the hungry? Or are these rich and beautiful people suffering even now? Of course, suffering is all around us, even here, where everything appears to be going well for the moment. First, the obvious. Within a few blocks of where I am sitting are hospitals, convalescent homes, psychiatrists' offices, and other rooms built to assuage or merely to contain some of the most profound forms of human misery. A man runs over his own child while backing his car out of the driveway. A woman learns that she has terminal cancer on the eve of her wedding. We know that the worst can happen to anyone at any time, and most people spend a great deal of mental energy hoping that it won't happen to them. But more subtle forms of suffering can be found even among people who seem to have every reason to be satisfied in the present. Although wealth and fame can secure many forms of pleasure, few of us have any illusions that they guarantee happiness. Anyone who owns a television or reads the newspaper has seen movie stars, politicians, professional athletes, and other celebrities ricochet from marriage to marriage and from scandal to scandal. To learn that a young, attractive, talented, and successful person is nevertheless addicted to drugs or clinically depressed, is to be given almost no cause for surprise. And yet the unsatisfactoriness of the good life runs deeper than this. Even while living safely between emergencies, most of us feel a wide range of painful emotions on a daily basis. When you wake up in the morning, are you filled with joy? How do you feel at work or when looking in the mirror? How satisfied are you with what you've accomplished in life? How much of your time with your family is spent surrendered to love and gratitude, and how much is spent just struggling to be happy in one another's company? Even for extraordinarily lucky people, life is difficult. And when we look at what makes it so, we see that we are all prisoners of our thoughts. And then there is death, which defeats everyone. Most people seem to believe that we have only two ways to think about death. We can fear it and do our best to ignore it, or we can deny that it is real. The first strategy leads to a life of conventional worldliness and distraction. We merely strive for pleasure and success and do our best to keep the reality of death out of view. The second strategy is the province of religion, which assures us that death is but a doorway to another world, and that the most important opportunities in life occur after the lifetime of the body. But there's another path, and it seems to be the only one compatible with intellectual honesty. That path is the subject of this book. Enlightenment. What is enlightenment, which is so often said to be the ultimate goal of meditation? There are many esoteric details that we can safely ignore, disagreements among contemplative traditions about what exactly is gained or lost at the end of the spiritual path. Many of these claims are preposterous. Within most schools of Buddhism, for instance, a Buddha, whether the historical Buddha Siddhartha Gautama or any other person who attains the state of, quote, full enlightenment, is generally described as omniscient. Just what this means is open to a fair bit of cavilling. But however narrowly defined, the claim is absurd. If the historical Buddha were omniscient, he would have been at minimum a better mathematician, physicist, biologist, and Jeopardy contestant than any person who has ever lived. Is it reasonable to expect that an ascetic in the 5th century BC, by virtue of his meditative insights, spontaneously became an unprecedented genius in every field of human inquiry, including those which did not exist at the time in which he lived? Would Siddhartha Gautama have awed Kurt Gödel, Alan Turing, John von Neumann, and Claude Shannon with his command of mathematical logic and information theory? Of course not. To think otherwise is pure religious piety. Any extension of the notion of omniscience to procedural knowledge, that is, knowing how to do something, would render the Buddha capable of painting the Sistine Chapel in the morning and demolishing Roger Federer at center court in the afternoon. Is there any reason to believe that Siddhartha Gautama or any other celebrated contemplative possessed such abilities by virtue of his spiritual practice? None whatsoever. Nevertheless, many Buddhists believe that Buddhas can do all these things and more. Again, this is religious dogmatism, not a rational approach to spiritual life. I make no claims in support of magic or miracles in this book. However, I can say that the true goal of meditation is more profound than most people realize, and it does in fact encompass many of the experiences that traditional mystics claim for themselves. It is quite possible to lose one's sense of being a separate self, and to experience a kind of boundless open awareness, to feel, in other words, at one with the cosmos. This says a lot about the possibilities of human consciousness, but it says nothing about the universe at large, and it sheds no light at all on the relationship between mind and matter. The fact that it is possible to love one's neighbor as oneself should be a great finding for the field of psychology, but it lends absolutely no credence to the claim that Jesus was the Son of God, or even that God exists. Nor does it suggest that the, quote, energy of love somehow pervades the cosmos. These are historical and metaphysical claims that personal experience cannot justify. However, a phenomenon like self-transcending love does entitle us to make claims about the human mind, and this particular experience is so well attested and so readily achieved by those who devote themselves to specific practices, the Buddhist technique of metta meditation, for instance, or who even take the right drug, MDMA, that there is very little controversy that it exists. Facts of this kind must now be understood in a rational context. The traditional goal of meditation is to arrive at a state of well-being that is imperturbable, or if perturbed, easily regained. The French monk Matthieu Ricard describes such happiness as, quote, a deep sense of flourishing that arises from an exceptionally healthy mind. The purpose of meditation is to recognize that you already have such a mind. That discovery, in turn, helps you to cease doing the things that produce needless confusion and suffering for yourself and others. Of course, most people never truly master the practice and don't reach a condition of imperturbable happiness. The near goal, therefore, is to have an increasingly healthy mind. That is, to be moving one's mind in the right direction. There is nothing novel about trying to become happy, and one can become happy within certain limits without any recourse to the practice of meditation. But conventional sources of happiness are unreliable, being dependent upon changing conditions. It is difficult to raise a happy family, to keep yourself and those you love healthy, to acquire wealth and find creative and fulfilling ways to enjoy it, to form deep friendships, to contribute to society in ways that are emotionally rewarding. to perfect a wide variety of artistic, athletic, and intellectual skills, and to keep the machinery of happiness running day after day. There's nothing wrong with being fulfilled in all these ways, except for the fact that if you pay close attention, you will see that there is still something wrong with it. These forms of happiness aren't good enough. Our feelings of fulfillment do not last, and the stress of life continues. So what would a spiritual master be master of? At a minimum, she will no longer suffer certain cognitive and emotional illusions. Above all, she will no longer feel identical to her thoughts. Once again, this is not to say that such a person will no longer think, but she will no longer succumb to the primary confusion that thoughts produce in most of us. She will no longer feel that there is an inner self who is a thinker of these thoughts. Such a person will naturally maintain an openness and serenity of mind that is available to most of us only for brief moments, even after years of practice. I remain agnostic as to whether anyone has achieved such a state permanently, but I know from direct experience that it is possible to be far more enlightened than I tend to be. The question of whether enlightenment is a permanent state need not detain us. The crucial point is that you can glimpse something about the nature of consciousness that will liberate you from suffering in the present. Even just recognizing the impermanence of your mental states, deeply, not merely as an idea, can transform your life. Every mental state you have ever had has arisen and then passed away. This is a first-person fact, but it is nonetheless a fact that any human being can readily confirm. We don't have to know any more about the brain or about the relationship between consciousness and the physical world to understand this truth about our own minds. The promise of spiritual life, indeed the very thing that makes it spiritual in the sense that I invoke throughout this book, is that there are truths about the mind that we are better off knowing. What we need to become happier and to make the world a better place is not more pious illusions, but a clearer understanding of the way things are. The moment we admit to the possibility of attaining contemplative insights and of training one's mind for that purpose, we must acknowledge that people naturally fall at different points on a continuum between ignorance and wisdom. Part of this range will be considered, quote, normal. But normal isn't necessarily a happy place to be. Just as a person's physical body and abilities can be refined, Olympic athletes are not normal. One's mental life can deepen and expand on the basis of talent and training. This is nearly self-evident, but it remains a controversial point. No one hesitates to admit the role of talent and training in the context of physical and intellectual pursuits. I have never met another person who denied that some of us are stronger, more athletic, or more learned than others. But many people find it difficult to acknowledge that a continuum of moral and spiritual wisdom exists, or that there might be better and worse ways to traverse it. Stages of spiritual development, therefore, appear unavoidable. Just as we must grow into adulthood physically, and we can fail to mature or become sick or injured along the way, our minds develop by degrees. One can't learn sophisticated skills such as syllogistic reasoning, algebra, or irony until one has acquired more basic skills. It seems to me that a healthy spiritual life can begin only once our physical, mental, social, and ethical lives have sufficiently matured. We must learn to use language before we can work with it creatively or understand its limits, and the conventional self must form before we can investigate it and understand that it is not what it appears to be. An ability to examine the contents of one's own consciousness clearly, dispassionately, and non-discursively, with sufficient attention to realize that no inner self exists, is a very sophisticated skill, and yet basic mindfulness can be practiced very early in life. Many people, including my wife, have successfully taught it to children as young as 6. At that age, and every age thereafter, it can be a powerful tool for self-regulation and self-awareness. Contemplatives have long understood that positive habits of mind are best viewed as skills that most of us learn imperfectly as we grow to adulthood. It is possible to become more focused, patient, and compassionate than one naturally tends to be, and there are many things to learn about how to be happy in this world. These are truths that Western psychological science has only recently begun to explore. Some people are content in the midst of deprivation and danger, while others are miserable despite having all the luck in the world. This is not to say that external circumstances do not matter, but it is your mind, rather than the circumstances themselves, that determines the quality of your life. Your mind is the basis of everything you experience and of every contribution you make to the lives of others. Given this fact, it makes sense to train it. Scientists and skeptics generally assume that the traditional claims of yogis and mystics must be exaggerated or simply delusional, and that the only rational purpose of meditation is limited to conventional, quote, stress reduction. Conversely, serious students of these practices often insist that even the most outlandish claims made by and about spiritual masters are true. I am attempting to lead you along a middle path between these extremes, one that preserves our scientific skepticism but acknowledges that it is possible to radically transform our minds. In one sense, the Buddhist concept of enlightenment really is just the epitome of stress reduction. And depending on how much stress one reduces, the results of one's practice can seem more or less profound. According to the Buddhist teachings, human beings have a distorted view of reality that leads them to suffer unnecessarily. We grasp at transitory pleasures. We brood about the past and worry about the future. We continually seek to prop up and defend an egoic self that doesn't exist. This is stressful, and spiritual life is a process of gradually unraveling our confusion and bringing this stress to an end. According to the Buddhist view, by seeing things as they are, we cease to suffer in the usual ways, and our minds can open to states of well-being that are intrinsic to the nature of consciousness. Of course, some people claim to love stress and appear eager to live by its logic. Some even derive pleasure from imposing stress on others. Genghis Khan is reported to have said, "The greatest happiness is to scatter your enemy and drive him before you, to see his cities reduced to ashes, to see those who love him shrouded in tears, and to gather to your bosom his wives and daughters." People attach many meanings to terms like happiness, and not all of them are compatible with one another. In the moral landscape, I argue that we tend to be unnecessarily confused about differences of opinion on the topic of human well-being. No doubt certain people can derive mental pleasure and even experience genuine ecstasy by behaving in ways that produce immense suffering for others. But we know that these states are anomalous, or at least not sustainable, because we depend upon one another for more or less everything. Whatever the associated pleasures, raping and pillaging can't be a stable strategy for finding happiness in this world. Given our social requirements, we know that the deepest and most durable forms of well-being must be compatible with an ethical concern for other people, even for complete strangers. Otherwise, violent conflict becomes inevitable. We also know that there are certain forms of happiness that are not available to a person, even if, like Genghis Khan, he finds himself on the winning side of every siege. Some pleasures are intrinsically ethical, feelings like love, gratitude, devotion, and compassion. To inhabit these states of mind is, by definition, to be brought into alignment with others. In my view, the realistic goal to be attained through spiritual practice is not some permanent state of enlightenment that admits of no further efforts, but a capacity to be free in this moment, in the midst of whatever is happening. If you can do that, you have already solved most of the problems you will encounter in life. Chapter 2. The Mystery of Consciousness. Investigating the nature of consciousness itself and transforming its contents through deliberate training is the basis of spiritual life. In scientific terms, however, consciousness remains notoriously difficult to understand or even to define. In fact, many debates about its character have been waged without the participants finding even a common topic as common ground. While we need not recapitulate the history of our confusion on this point, it will be useful to briefly examine why consciousness still poses a unique challenge to science. Having done so, we will see that spirituality is not just important for living a good life, it is actually essential for understanding the human mind. In one of the most influential essays on consciousness ever written, the philosopher Thomas Nagel asks us to consider what it is like to be a bat. His interest isn't in bats, but in how we define the concept of consciousness. Nagel argues that an organism is conscious, quote, if and only if there is something that it is like to be that organism, something that it is like for the organism, end quote. Whether you find that statement brilliant, trivial, or merely perplexing, probably says a lot about your appetite for philosophy. Brilliant and trivial can both be defended, but Nagel's claim needn't leave you confused. He's simply asking you to imagine trading places with a bat. If you would be left with any experience, however indescribable, some spectrum of sight, sound, sensations, feelings, that is what consciousness is in the case of a bat. If being transformed into a bat were tantamount to annihilation, however, then bats are not conscious. Nagel's point is that whatever else consciousness may or may not entail in physical terms, the difference between it and unconsciousness is a matter of subjective experience. Either the lights are on, or they are not. But experience is one thing, and our growing scientific picture of reality is another. At this moment, you might be vividly aware of listening to this book, but you are completely unaware of the electrochemical events occurring at each of the trillions of synapses in your brain. However much you may know about physics, chemistry, and biology, you live elsewhere. As a matter of your experience, you are not a body of atoms, molecules, and cells. You are consciousness and its ever-changing contents, passing through various stages of wakefulness and sleep, from cradle to grave. And the question of how consciousness relates to the physical world remains famously unresolved. There are reasons to believe that it emerges on the basis of information processing in complex systems like a human brain, because when we look at the universe, we find it filled with simpler structures, like stars, and processes, like nuclear fusion, that offer no outward sign of consciousness. But our intuitions here may not amount to much. After all, how would the sun appear if it were conscious? Perhaps exactly as it does now. Would you expect it to talk? And yet somehow it seems far less likely that stars are conscious and simply mute than that they lack inner lives altogether. Whatever the ultimate relationship between consciousness and matter, almost everyone will agree that at some point in the development of complex organisms like ourselves, consciousness seems to emerge. This emergence does not depend upon a change of materials, for you and I are built of the same atoms as a fern or a ham sandwich. Instead, the birth of consciousness must be the result of organization. Arranging atoms in certain ways appears to bring about an experience of being that very collection of atoms. This is undoubtedly one of the deepest mysteries given to us to contemplate. Nevertheless, Nagel was right to observe that the reality of consciousness is, first and foremost, subjective, for it is simply the fact of subjectivity itself. And whether something seems conscious from the outside is never quite the point. I happen to know a person who once woke up during a surgery for which he had received a general anesthetic. Owing to the paralytic component of the anesthesia, however, he was unable to signal to his doctors that he was awake and feeling rather more of the procedure than he liked. This was inconvenient, to say the least, because they were in the process of replacing his liver. If you think that the important part of consciousness is its link to speech and behavior, spare a moment to consider the problem of anesthesia awareness. It is a cure for much bad philosophy. It is surely a sign of intellectual progress that a discussion of consciousness need no longer begin with a debate about its existence. To say that consciousness may only seem to exist from the inside is to admit its existence in full. For if things seem any way at all, that is consciousness. Even if I happen to be a brain in a vat at this moment, all my memories are false, and all my perceptions are of a world that does not exist. The fact that I am having an experience is indisputable, to me at least. This is all that is required for me or any other sentient being to fully establish the reality of consciousness. Consciousness is the one thing in this universe that cannot be an illusion. As our understanding of the physical world has evolved, our notion of what counts as physical has broadened considerably. A world teeming with fields and forces, vacuum fluctuations, and the other gossamer spawn of modern physics is not the physical world of common sense. In fact, our common sense seems to be stuck somewhere in the 16th century. It has also been generally forgotten that many of the patriarchs of physics in the first half of the 20th century regularly impugned the physicality of the universe and placed mind or thoughts or consciousness itself at the very wellspring of reality. Non-reductive views like those of Arthur Eddington, James Jeans, Wolfgang Pauli, Werner Heisenberg, and Erwin Schrödinger seem to have had no lasting impact. In some ways, we can be thankful for this, for a fair amount of mumbo-jumbo was in the air. Pauli, for instance, was a devotee of Carl Jung, who apparently analyzed no fewer than 1,300 of the great man's dreams. Although Pauli was one of the titans of physics, his thoughts about the irreducibility of mind probably had as much to do with Jung's febrile imagination as they did with quantum mechanics. The allure of the numinous eventually subsided. Once physicists got down to the serious business of building bombs, we were apparently returned to a universe of objects, and to a style of discourse across all branches of science and philosophy that made the mind seem ripe for reduction to the, quote, physical world. These developments have greatly inconvenienced New Age thinkers, or would have had they deigned to notice them. Authors struggling to link spirituality to science generally pin their hopes on misunderstandings of the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics, which they take as proof that consciousness plays a central role in determining the character of the physical world. If nothing is real until it is observed, consciousness cannot arise from electrochemical events in the brains of animals like ourselves. Rather, it must be part of the very fabric of reality. But this simply isn't the position of mainstream physics. It is true that according to Copenhagen, quantum mechanical systems do not behave classically until they are observed, and before that, they may seem to exist in many different states simultaneously. But what counts as an observation under the original Copenhagen view was never clearly defined. The notion has been refined since, and it has nothing to do with consciousness. It's not that the mysteries of quantum mechanics have been resolved. The physical picture is strange however one looks at it. And the problem of how an underlying quantum mechanical reality becomes the seemingly classical world of tables and chairs hasn't been completely understood. However, there is no reason to think that consciousness is integral to the process. It seems certain, therefore, that anyone who would base his spirituality on misinterpretations of 1930s physics is bound to be disappointed. As we will see, the link between spirituality and science must be found in another place. We know, of course, that human minds are the product of human brains. There is simply no question that your ability to decode and understand this sentence depends upon neurophysiological events taking place inside your head at this moment. But most of this mental work occurs entirely in the dark, and it is a mystery why any part of the process should be attended by consciousness. Nothing about a brain, when surveyed as a physical system, suggests that it is a locus of experience. Were we not already brimming with consciousness ourselves, we would find no evidence for it in the universe, nor would we have any notion of the many experiential states that it gives rise to. The only proof that it is like something to be you at this moment is the fact, obvious only to you, that it is like something to be you. However we propose to explain the emergence of consciousness, be it in biological, functional, computational, or any other terms, we have committed ourselves to this much. First, there is a physical world, unconscious and seething with unperceived events. Then, by virtue of some physical property or process, consciousness itself springs or staggers into being. This idea seems to me not merely strange, but perfectly mysterious. That doesn't mean it isn't true. When we linger over the details, however, this notion of emergence seems merely a placeholder for a miracle. Consciousness, the sheer fact that this universe is illuminated by sentience, is precisely what unconsciousness is not, and I believe that no description of unconscious complexity will fully account for it. To simply assert that consciousness arose at some point in the evolution of life and that it results from a specific arrangement of neurons firing in concert within an individual brain doesn't give us any inkling of how it could emerge from unconscious processes, even in principle. However, this is not to say that some other thesis about consciousness must be true. Consciousness may very well be the lawful product of unconscious information processing. But I don't know what that sentence actually means, and I don't think anyone else does either. This situation has been characterized as an explanatory gap and as the hard problem of consciousness, and it is surely both. Some philosophers have suggested that the relationship between mind and body will be understood only with reference to concepts that are neither physical nor mental, but are in some sense neutral. Others claim that consciousness can be known to be the product of physical causes, but cannot be conceptually reduced to such causes. Still others have argued that the notion of a non-reductive physical account is incoherent. I am sympathetic with those who, like the philosopher Colin McGinn and the psychologist Steven Pinker, have suggested that perhaps the emergence of consciousness is simply incomprehensible in human terms. Every chain of explanation must end somewhere, generally with a brute fact that neglects to explain itself. Perhaps consciousness presents an impasse of this sort. In any case, the task of explaining consciousness in physical terms bears little resemblance to other successful explanations in the history of science. The analogies that scientists and philosophers marshal here are invariably misleading. The fact, for instance, that we can now describe properties of matter, such as fluidity, in terms of microscopic events that are not themselves fluid, does not suggest a way to understand consciousness as an emergent property of the unconscious world. It is easy to see that no single water molecule can be fluid, and it is easy to see that billions of such molecules, freely sliding past one another, would appear as fluidity on the scale of a human hand. What is not easy to see is how analogies of this kind have persuaded so many people that consciousness can be readily explained in terms of information processing. For an explanation of a phenomenon to be satisfying, it must first be, at minimum, intelligible. In this regard, the emergence of fluidity poses no problems. The free sliding of molecules seems exactly the sort of thing that should be true of a substance to ensure its fluidity. Why can I pass my hand through liquid water and not through rock? Because the molecules of water are not bound so tightly as to resist my motion. Notice that this explanation of fluidity is perfectly reductive. Fluidity really is nothing but the free motion of molecules. For this explanation to be sufficient, we must first admit that molecules exist, of course, but once we do, the problem is solved. No one has described a set of unconscious events whose sufficiency as a cause of consciousness would make sense in this way. Any attempt to understand consciousness in terms of brain activity merely correlates a person's ability to report an experience, demonstrating that he was aware of it, with specific states of his brain. While such correlations can amount to fascinating neuroscience, they bring us no closer to explaining the emergence of consciousness itself. There will almost certainly come a time when we will build a robot whose facial expressiveness, tone of voice, and flexibility of thought will cause us to wonder whether or not it is conscious. This robot might even claim to be conscious and be eager to participate in the kinds of experiments we now perform on human beings, allowing us to correlate its responses to stimuli with changes in its brain. It seems clear, however, that unless we can do more than this, we will never know whether there is something that it is like to be such a machine. Some listeners may think I've stacked the deck against the sciences of mind by comparing consciousness to a phenomenon so easily understood as fluidity. Surely science has dispelled far greater mysteries. What, for instance, is the difference between a living system and a dead one? Insofar as questions about consciousness itself can be kept off the table, it seems that the difference is now reasonably clear to us. And yet as late as 1932, the Scottish physiologist J.S. Haldane, father of J.B.S. Haldane, wrote the following. What intelligible account can the mechanistic theory of life give of the recovery from disease and injuries? Simply none at all, except that these phenomena are so complex and strange that as yet we cannot understand them. It is exactly the same with the closely related phenomena of reproduction. We cannot by any stretch of the imagination conceive a delicate and complex mechanism which is capable, like a living organism, of reproducing itself indefinitely often. Scarcely 20 years passed before our imaginations were duly stretched. Much work in biology remains to be done, but anyone who entertains vitalism at this point is simply ignorant about the nature of living systems. The jury is no longer out on questions of this kind, and more than half a century has passed since the Earth's creatures required an élan vital to propagate themselves or to recover from injury. Is my skepticism that we will arrive at a physical explanation of consciousness analogous to Haldane's doubt about the feasibility of explaining life in terms of processes that are not themselves alive? It wouldn't seem so. To say that a system is alive is very much like saying that it is fluid, because life is a matter of what systems do with respect to their environment. Like fluidity, life is defined according to external criteria. Consciousness is not, and I think cannot be. We would never have occasion to say of something that does not eat, excrete, grow, or reproduce, that it might be alive. It might, however, be conscious. Might a mature neuroscience nevertheless offer a proper explanation of consciousness in terms of its underlying brain processes? Again, there is nothing about a brain, studied at any scale, that even suggests that it might harbor consciousness, apart from the fact that we experience consciousness directly and have correlated many of its contents, or lack thereof, with processes in our brains. Nothing about human behavior, or language, or culture demonstrates that it is mediated by consciousness, apart from the fact that we simply know that it is, a truth that someone can appreciate in himself directly and in others by analogy. Here is where the distinction between studying consciousness itself and studying its contents becomes paramount. It is easy to see that the contents of consciousness might be understood in neurophysiological terms. Consider, for instance, our experience of seeing an object. its color, contours, apparent motion, and location in space arise in consciousness as a seamless unity, even though this information is processed by many separate systems in the brain. Thus, when a golfer prepares to hit a shot, he does not first see the ball's roundness, then its whiteness, and only then its position on the tee. Rather, he enjoys a unified perception of the ball. Many neuroscientists believe that this phenomenon of, quote, binding can be explained by disparate groups of neurons firing in synchrony. Whether or not this theory is true, it is at least intelligible, because synchronous activity seems just the sort of thing that could explain the unity of a percept. This work suggests, as many other findings in neuroscience do, that the contents of consciousness can often be made sense of in terms of their underlying neurophysiology. However, when we ask why such phenomena should be experienced in the first place, we are returned to the mystery of consciousness in full. Unfortunately, efforts to locate consciousness in the brain generally fail to distinguish between consciousness and its contents. As a result, many researchers have taken one form of consciousness, or one class of its contents, as a sufficient view of the whole. For instance, Christoph Koch and others have done some very clever work on vision, looking for which regions of the brain encode conscious visual perception. The phenomenon of binocular rivalry has provided an especially useful foothold here. It just so happens that when each eye is presented with a different visual stimulus, a person's conscious experience is not a blending of the two images, but rather a series of apparently random transitions between them. If, for instance, you are shown a picture of a house in one eye and a human face in the other, you will not see the two images competing with each other or otherwise superimposed. You will see the house for a few seconds, and then the face, and then the house again, switching at random intervals. This phenomenon has allowed experimenters to look for those regions of the brain in both humans and monkeys that respond to a change in conscious perception. The psychophysical situation seems tailor-made to distinguish the frontier between conscious and unconscious components of vision, because the input remains constant. Each eye receives the continuous impression of a single image, while somewhere in the brain, a wholesale change in the contents of consciousness occurs every few seconds. This is very interesting, and yet subjects experiencing binocular rivalry are conscious throughout the experiment. Only the contents of visual awareness have been modulated by the task. If you shut your eyes at this moment, the contents of your consciousness change quite drastically, but your consciousness, arguably, does not. This is not to say that our understanding of the mind won't change in surprising ways through our study of the brain. There may be no limit to how a maturing neuroscience might reshape our beliefs about the nature of conscious experience. Are we unconscious during sleep or merely unable to remember what sleep is like? Can human minds be duplicated? Neuroscience may one day answer such questions, and the answers might well surprise us. But the reality of consciousness appears irreducible. Only consciousness can know itself, and directly, through first-person experience. It follows, therefore, that rigorous introspection, spirituality in the widest sense of the term, is an indispensable part of understanding the nature of the mind. The mind divided. If spirituality is to become part of science, however, it must integrate with the rest of what we know about the world. It has long been obvious that traditional approaches to spirituality cannot do this, being based, to one or another degree, on religious myths and superstitions. Consider the idea that human beings, alone among nature's animals, have been installed with immortal souls. This dogma came under pressure the moment Darwin published On the Origin of Species in 1859, but it is now truly dead. By sequencing a wide variety of genomes, we have finally rendered our continuity with the rest of life undeniable. We are such stuff as yeasts are made of. Of course, only 25% of Americans believe in evolution, while 68% believe in the literal existence of Satan. But we can now say that any conception of our place in the universe that denies that we evolved from more primitive life forms is pure delusion. Neuroscience has also produced results that are equally hostile to the traditional idea of souls, and therefore to any approach to spirituality that presupposes their existence. One such finding, conclusively demonstrated in humans and animals since the 1950s, is widely known as the split brain, a phenomenon so at odds with common sense that even within the culture of science, it has defied integration into our thoughts. The human brain is divided at the level of the cerebrum, everything above the brainstem, into right and left hemispheres. The reason for this is still unclear, but it does not seem altogether strange that the left-right symmetry of our bodies would be reflected in our central nervous system. This structure turns out to have surprising consequences. The right and left hemispheres of all vertebrate brains are connected by several nerve tracts called commissures, the function of which, we now know, is to pass information back and forth between them. The main commissure in the brains of placental mammals like ourselves is the corpus callosum, the fibers of which link similar regions of the cortex across the hemispheres. The evolutionary history of this structure is still a matter of dispute, but in human beings it represents a larger system of connectivity than the sum of all the fibers linking the cortex to the rest of the nervous system. As we are about to see, the unity of every human mind depends on the normal functioning of these connections. Without them, our brains and minds are divided. Certain people have had their forebrain commissures surgically severed. This is generally undertaken as a treatment for severe epilepsy, though other surgeries occasionally require that some of these fibers be cut. As a treatment for epilepsy, patients usually receive a callosotomy, a procedure whereby most or all of the corpus callosum is severed to prevent local storms of unregulated activity from spreading throughout the brain and producing a seizure. The split brain was brought to the world's attention half a century ago by Roger W. Sperry and colleagues. Sperry was awarded a Nobel Prize in 1981 for this work, which inspired a literature that now spans neuroscience, psychology, linguistics, psychiatry, and philosophy. Before Sperry began his research, it appeared that dividing the brains of these patients simply mitigated their seizures, which was, after all, the point, without producing any changes in their behavior. This seemed to lend credence to the ancient notion that the corpus callosum does nothing more than hold the two hemispheres of the brain together. Once patients recover from this surgery, they generally appear quite normal, even on neurological exam. Under the experimental conditions that Sperry and his colleagues devised, however, first in cats and monkeys and then in humans, two principal findings emerged. First, the left and right hemispheres of the brain display a high degree of functional specialization. This discovery was not entirely new because it had been known for at least a century that damage to the left hemisphere could impair the use of language. But the split-brain procedure allowed scientists to test each hemisphere independently on a variety of tasks, revealing a range of segregated abilities. The second finding was that when the forebrain commissures are cut, the hemispheres display an altogether astonishing functional independence, including separate memories, learning processes, behavioral intentions, and, it seems all but certain, centers of conscious experience. The independence of the hemispheres in a split-brain patient comes about because most nerve tracts running to and from the cortex are segregated, left and right. Everything that falls in the left visual field of each eye, for instance, is projected to the right hemisphere of the brain, and everything in the right visual field is projected to the left hemisphere. The same pattern holds for both sensation and fine motor control in our extremities. Thus, each hemisphere relies on intact commissures to receive information from its own side of the world. While it can rarely speak, because speech is usually confined to the left hemisphere, the right hemisphere can respond to questions by pointing to written words and objects with the left hand. The classic demonstration of hemispheric independence in a split-brain patient runs as follows. Show the right hemisphere a word, egg, say, by briefly flashing it in the left half of the visual field, and the subject, speaking from his language-dominant left hemisphere, will claim to have seen nothing at all. Ask him to reach behind a partition and select with his left hand, which is predominantly controlled by the right hemisphere, the thing that he, quote, did not see, and he will succeed in picking out an egg from among a multitude of objects. Ask him to name the item he now holds in his left hand, without allowing the left hemisphere to get a look at it, and he will be unable to reply. If shown the egg, and asked why he selected it from among the available materials, he will probably confabulate an answer, again with his language-dominant left hemisphere, saying something like, "Oh, I picked it because I had eggs for breakfast yesterday." This is a peculiar state of affairs. When the lateralization of inputs to the brain is exploited in this way, it becomes difficult to say that the person whose brain has been split is a single subject, for everything about his behavior suggests that a silent intelligence lurks in his right hemisphere, about which the articulate left hemisphere knows nothing. The duality of mind is further demonstrated by the fact that these patients can simultaneously perform separate manual tasks. For instance, a person whose brain is functioning normally will find it impossible to draw incompatible figures simultaneously with right and left hands. Divided brains accomplish this task easily, like two artists working in parallel. In the acute phase after surgery, patients' left and right hands sometimes engage in a tug of war over an object or sabotage each other's work. The left hemisphere can speak about its condition and may even understand the anatomical details of the procedure that has brought it about. Yet it remains remarkably naive about the experience of its neighbor on the right. Even many years after surgery, the left hemispheres of these subjects express surprise and irritation when their right hemispheres respond to an experimenter's instructions. To ask the left hemisphere what it is like not to know what the right hemisphere is thinking is rather like asking a normal subject what it is like not to know what another person is thinking. He simply does not know what the other person is thinking, or even perhaps that he or she exists. What is most startling about the split-brain phenomenon is that we have every reason to believe that the isolated right hemisphere is independently conscious. It is true that some scientists and philosophers have resisted this conclusion, but none have done so credibly. If complex language were necessary for consciousness, then all non-human animals and human infants would be devoid of consciousness in principle. If those whose left hemispheres have been surgically removed are still believed to be conscious, and they are, how could the mere presence of a functioning left hemisphere rob the right one of its subjectivity in the case of a split-brain patient? The consciousness of the right hemisphere is especially difficult to deny whenever a subject possesses linguistic ability on both sides of the brain, because in such cases the divided hemispheres often express different intentions. In a famous example, a young patient was asked what he wanted to be when he grew up. His left brain replied, "A draftsman," while his right brain used letter cards to spell out "racing driver." In fact, the divided hemispheres sometimes seem to address each other directly in the form of a verbalized interhemispheric argument. In such cases, each hemisphere might well have its own beliefs. Consider what this says about the dogma, widely held under Christianity and Islam, that a person's salvation depends upon her believing the right doctrine about God. If a split-brain patient's left hemisphere accepts the divinity of Jesus, but the right doesn't, are we to imagine that she now harbors two immortal souls, one destined for the company of angels and the other for an eternity in hellfire? The question of whether there is something that it is like to be the right hemisphere of a split-brain patient must be answered in the only way that it is ever answered in science. We can merely observe that its behavior and underlying neurology are sufficiently similar to that which we know to be correlated with consciousness in our own case. There is no difficulty in doing this for a normal split-brain patient who retains the use of her left hand. In fact, the consciousness of the disconnected right hemisphere is easier to establish than that for most toddlers. The question of whether the right hemisphere is conscious is really a pseudo-mystery used to bar the door to a great one, the uncanny fact that the human mind can be divided with a knife. Structure and function. The right and left hemispheres of our brain show differences in their gross anatomy, many of which are also found in the brains of other animals. In humans, the left hemisphere generally makes a unique contribution to language and to the performance of complex movements. Consequently, damage on this side tends to be accompanied by aphasia, impairment of spoken or written language, and apraxia, impairment of coordinated movement. People usually show a right ear, left hemisphere, advantage for words, digits, nonsense syllables, Morse code, difficult rhythms, and the ordering of temporal information, whereas they show a left ear, right hand.